Politics, persecution, and the Protestant Reformation all swirled around the Dutch revolt against the monarchy.
This revolt then began not in the name of religion, but in the name of freedom. William of Orange said right from the beginning, although he had become a Calvinist, we mustn't make this revolt a religious revolt or it'll split the country.
Stay tuned. Renewing Your Mind is next. You know, as the Protestant Reformation swept through Europe, political upheaval followed. That was certainly the case in the Netherlands in the 16th century. Hello and welcome. Over the past several months on this, the Saturday edition of our program, Dr. W. Robert Godfrey has given us a guided tour of the people and events in church history, all part of a comprehensive series that Dr. Godfrey taught here on the Ligonier Ministries campus over 4 years. We're making the entire 73-lesson series available to you, and I'll let you know how to request that with your gift of any amount at the end of the program. But right now, here's Dr. Godfrey with more on the Dutch Reformation.
In the last lecture, we looked at the reception of the Reformation in Scotland and some of the political and religious turmoil, but also improvement that it brought about there. In this lecture, I want to look at a different part of Europe and the reception of the Reformation there. It's what we often call the Dutch Reformation, but in the 16th century, it would have been called the Reformation of the Low Countries. In fact, Netherlands, of course, is just a more Latinate way of saying Low Countries. In the 16th century, the Low Countries were not a single country, although they did have a lot of historic connections with one another. They were actually 17 provinces of what today make up the Netherlands, Belgium, and the north of France. They were a region that each had their own traditions. To some extent, they had their own languages. Frisian spoken in the north, Dutch spoken in the middle, and French spoken in the south. Had their own constitutions, each of the 17 countries or counties. It was a very wealthy part of Europe, a rather populated part of Europe, and therefore important to the ruler of that area. The Emperor Charles V was the ruler of the Low Countries, but not because he was emperor, but because he was the Count of Holland and the Count of Flanders and the Count of Friesland. In other words, he held authority there by title to each of the 17 provinces. And that's important to the history because each of them had their own measure of pride. Each of them had a sense of what was owed them by their lord. And as we'll see, the coming of the Reformation brought significant challenges and ultimately huge changes to that region. The Reformation reached the Low Countries early. In fact, probably the first martyrs of the Reformation died in Brussels, two monks who had been attracted to Lutheranism and were executed in 1523. So early on, the Reformation begins to come to the Netherlands, initially in its Lutheran form, but it really begins to grow when Anabaptists began to preach in the Netherlands. So the first kind of large manifestation of Reformation came with Anabaptists, and Menno Simons was from the Netherlands, from the northern part of the Netherlands. Calvinism begins to come to the Low Countries in the early 1540s, and it comes in the French part, the French-speaking part of the Low Countries. So preachers trained in Geneva might for a time preach in France and then move up to the northern regions of France and then move into the southern parts of the Low Countries. And it was there that there was initially a significant receptivity to the preaching of the Calvinist preachers. That's ironic because, of course, today Belgium is a fairly solidly Roman Catholic country, where the northern Netherlands is the more Protestant part. We'll talk about how that happened. But initially, there was great response to the preaching in the south, but that preaching was difficult and that preaching was dangerous. There was strong government opposition. Charles felt he couldn't oppose Protestantism as vigorously as he wanted to in Germany, but he was going to oppose it vigorously in the Netherlands, where he had more immediate and direct control. And so those churches formed in the early years, in the 1540s, the 1550s, were frequently referred to as churches under the cross. And what that meant was churches suffering persecution. Very often, the preachers could not gather in public. They had to preach out in the countryside. Very often, they could meet only in very small groups. One of the early preachers who wrote the Belgic Confession, a man by the name of Guido de Bray, Debray would frequently preach only at sort of dinner parties. That was the only kind of safe gathering, 10, 12 people invited to a home for dinner, and he would preach there. It was very dangerous work. Guido de Bray would ultimately die a martyr for the faith, the only confession writer of the Reformed who did die as a martyr. So these were heroic days. These were days of great risk, but also of great blessing of the Lord on the churches. And they continued to grow. And as they grew, they began to press north more into Dutch-speaking regions. And this led to a growing consternation on the part of the government. What are we going to do about this growing Protestantism? Well, in 1555, you remember, Charles V had abdicated because he wouldn't agree to the Peace of Augsburg. And his territories were split up between his brother and his son Philip, and it was his son Philip, who was king of Spain, who received from his father the Low Countries. Now, Charles had been raised in the Netherlands, could speak to the people, understood the customs, understood the ways of the Low Countries. Philip had been raised exclusively in Spain. He only spoke Spanish. He didn't understand the traditions, the notions of historic freedoms and constitutional rights of the Low Countries. And the result was that Philip rather quickly became seen as a foreign oppressor. Whereas many people had appreciated Charles as a fair ruler, Philip II of Spain now was seen as a foreigner who had tried to increase taxes. That's never a way to curry favor with people. He had tried to find ways to enhance the church and to persecute the Protestants, and this led to a growing wave of resistance and culminated in an amazing moment in Dutch history in 1566 when a storm of iconoclasm swept across the country. Mobs throughout the country broke into Catholic churches, broke the images which they associated with idolatry, and it stunned the government. They had no idea of the extent of popular unrest and unhappiness. And so Philip decided that he was going to put an end to this, and he sent one of his key generals, the Duke of Alva, from Spain with troops up to the Netherlands to put an end to things. And when Alva got there, he formed what is known in Dutch history as the Council of Blood. The Iron Duke in his Council of Blood. It's part of the mythology of Dutch history. And it's why when, I think back in the 80s, a Dutch princess married a Spanish Bourbon, it almost toppled the monarchy in the Netherlands. There was still such anti-Spanish feeling in the Netherlands that the Parliament of the Netherlands had to pass a special law that the descendants of this Dutch princess could never sit on the throne because she had married a Spanish prince. 400 years later, there was still all of this feeling about what had gone on, how much suffering there had been under the Iron Duke. This led then to an uprising. To an uprising against Philip and against the Duke of Alva, led by William of Orange, known to history as William the Silent. He's William the Silent because he could keep his mouth shut at crucial times. It's a It's a skill not everybody has. He was the most distinguished nobleman of all of the Dutch aristocrats. And it's somewhat ironic because his blood is actually German. And to this day, the Dutch national anthem is the Wilhelmuslied, the William song. And the Dutch national anthem begins with the words, "I am William of Nassau, I am of German blood." That makes for a very strange Dutch national anthem. But anyway, probably even stranger during the Second World War. But that's ahead of our story. This revolt then began not in the name of religion, but in the name of freedom, in the name of opposition to tyranny. William of Orange said right from the beginning, although he had become a Calvinist, he said, "We mustn't make this revolt a religious revolt or it'll split the country. We need to make it a political revolt against a tyrant that'll unite the country." And so that was how the revolt began. They said, "Philip has broken his oath to the people to respect ancient liberties, and we now rise against this tyrant." And in due course, the Dutch abjured, that's one of my favorite words, abjured, threw off their allegiance to Philip, and that led them to raise the important question, well, who will rule over us? Initially, they went to William, and they said, "Will you become our ruler?" And William was really quite a noble man. He said, "I will not have history say of me that I led a revolt for my own personal success." You know, it's exactly what George Washington did. There were some people who asked George Washington to become king, and he said, "Absolutely not." And William of Orange was of that noble, really self-sacrificing character that he refused. And so then they began to say, "Well, who else could we get to be monarch?" And they thought, "What about Queen Elizabeth? Cross the channel. She'd be great." Now, as I've said to you before, Elizabeth was extraordinarily shrewd. And Elizabeth knew that in the 1570s, Spain was the most powerful and wealthy country in Europe. And she thought to herself, "There's no chance in the world that these Dutch people are going to beat Spain in the long run. But it's really good for me if they distract Spain." And so she sort of dangled the Dutch along for as long as she could. Then she got them to name a French prince that Elizabeth said, "I may well marry him." They appointed him the sovereign for a while, hoping they'd get Elizabeth in the bargain. Elizabeth then dumped him, and they were left with this guy. It was a very embarrassing situation. They finally dumped him. It's a little longer story than I'm making it, but it was complicated. And finally, the Dutch said, "I guess we'll just have to be a republic." Nobody wanted to be, nobody intended to be, but they couldn't find a sovereign willing to take them on. So they ended up as a republic. And the war drug on, and it was a difficult war because it was a war in a little country full of rivers, which made it hard for armies to move. And it was a little country full of fortified towns with strong defensive walls. So armies would have to find a way to cross the river, then they'd have to besiege a town, try to starve the town into submission. One of the great stories is in 1574, the Spanish troops besieged the city of Leiden. And it's a beautiful little city, but it was a fortified city in those days. And the city was slowly starving, and William of Orange wrote to the city and said, "You have to hold out. If you surrender, the country will be cut in half, and they'll be able to pick us off one by one. You have to hold out." And at great sacrifice, the city did hold out, many people starving. Then William succeeded in breaking the dikes. And one morning, the Spanish army woke up to find itself knee-deep in water and being attacked by the Dutch Navy. It had to be one of the more peculiar battles in military history. And the siege of Leiden was relieved, and the story goes that William came to the city and, in deep appreciation for their suffering and their faithfulness, said to them, in reward for your suffering, I will either establish a university here in your town, or I will exempt you forever from taxes. And the story goes that the noble people of Leiden said, no, we want a university. Anybody who knows Dutch people finds that story very hard to believe. But it was true, a university was founded there in 1574 to mark the heroism of the Dutch resistance and became a great center of Calvinistic learning in the 16th and 17th centuries, continues to this day as one of Europe's great universities. The problem was that as this war went on, increasingly, Philip was able to hold the South and not take the North. And Calvinists in the South began to move north to be safe. And this is what ultimately led to the division of Belgium and the Netherlands. Belgium became the territory that Philip held, and the Netherlands in the north was the territory that he couldn't hold. And so in the north, you had the Republic that came to be known as the United Provinces. That was their official title in the 16th, 17th, 18th century. And the United Provinces remained an independent republic until they were conquered by Napoleon at the very end of the 18th century. And it was then in that northern part of the Netherlands that the Reformed Church began to take on a more official status and role. The struggle continued, putting great pressure on the north until the early 17th century. And one of the saddest moments in that struggle came with the assassination of William of Orange. It's a very moving tale. Philip II of Spain hired an assassin to go north and to assassinate William. And this man came to the city of Delft, where William had a palace. And you can visit it to this day. It's not a really grand place. It's kind of just a, I don't think it's as grand as this place. But anyway, it's a nice big house. And this man came to William of Orange on the street and said, I'm a poor man. Can you give me some money? And William gave him money. And he took that money and went out and bought guns and came back and assassinated William in his own home. You can still see the bullet holes in the wall in Delft. There's a beautiful tomb for William. It was tragic because he was a wise and wonderful leader, but it shows the violence of the days, the difficulty of the struggle, the uncertainty of the outcome. What did become clear is that with the establishment of a state in the north, the Reformed Church was able to reach some stability, able to commit itself to the Belgic Confession that Guido de Bray had written and to the Heidelberg Catechism as their doctrinal standards, able to establish a church order that would govern the life of the churches, that would create consistories of elders and ministers and deacons to govern the local church, and then establish classes, as they were known, a classis or classes are roughly like a presbytery in Presbyterian circles, a kind of regional governing body. The difference is that a classis is a delegated assembly of churches rather than a regional church of office bearers. So every minister in the Dutch Reformed Church is a member of the local church and only delegated to classis. He's not a member of the presbytery the way Presbyterian ministers are. In any case, they were able to also have synods now. In the United Provinces in the north, there were 7 provinces of the original 17 that had escaped the rule of Philip. And each of those provinces would have their own regional synod. And then from time to time, they would have a national synod where the whole church would gather together. And so the Reformed Church became established. It began to grow. It began to have influence in the universities to train future ministers. And it was in that kind of situation then that there was an opening in the theological faculty at Leiden. And there were just 3 professors of theology, so the appointment was a rather serious business. The church took it very seriously. The Board of Trustees took it very seriously. And in 1603, there was an opening, and somebody suggested, well, there's a very talented young minister in Amsterdam by the name of Arminius, James or Jacobus Arminius. And they said, you know, he was born in the city of Oudwater in Holland. He studied at Leiden when it was a very young university. And then he went to Geneva to study. He came back with a glowing letter of recommendation from Theodore Beza. He's now been a preacher in Amsterdam. He had the good sense to marry well, a daughter of a rich man. He's clearly a clever guy. There's been a little concern about some of his sermons. He has some slightly peculiar ideas when he's preaching through Romans. When he got to Romans 7, he said Paul was talking about his unregenerate self, whereas Calvin said it was the regenerate Paul speaking in Romans 7. But they'd sort of gotten over that. He caused another little bit of concern when he got to Romans 9. People weren't quite sure how straight he was being on Romans 9. But nevertheless, he was highly recommended. So some of the strict Calvinists were a little suspicious. They said, well, let's ask the remaining faculty member at Leiden to interview him. And this was a well-known, well-regarded, and fairly prickly Calvinist by the name of Franciscus Gomarus. And they thought, well, you know, if Gomarus says he's all right, he must be all right. So Gomarus interviews Arminius, and he says, no, he's all right. He's fine. He'll be a good professor. So in 1603, Arminius becomes professor at Leiden. Now, bear in mind, he's got a letter of recommendation from Beza, who's a pretty tough nut in terms of orthodoxy, and now from Gomarus. But almost immediately after taking his position, rumors began to circulate. Is he teaching some students in private something different from what he's teaching in public? Then he wrote criticizing William Perkins on predestination, only criticizing, never quite making clear what he personally believed. He has the students reading Roman Catholic authors. What's going on here? What's going on here? And this led to growing tension, growing struggle, growing confusion. The synod begins an investigation, and then Arminius dies in 1609. Well, that's the end of the problem, right? Arminianism went away with the death of Arminius. Well, no, of course, that's never a solution to problems. It never goes away. He left a legacy amongst his students. What was that legacy? Well, we need to look at that in the next lecture. So we'll return to this subject of Arminianism and how the Dutch Reformed Church has faced it as a major threat to Reformation Christianity next time.
So interesting, isn't it, to see the political and religious landscape of this period? Dr. Robert Godfrey has been bringing clarity to church history on the Saturday edition of Renewing Your Mind over the past several months. Dr. Godfrey is a teaching fellow here at Ligonier Ministries, as well as president emeritus of Westminster Seminary, California. Over the course of 4 years, he carefully explained how the Church of Christ has thrived at certain times in history and survived in others, and we have witnessed God's faithfulness to His people throughout. We'd like to send you all 73 lessons from this series on 12 DVDs for your gift of any amount. Simply contact us and request it. You can find us at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us at 800-435-4343. I've heard it said that church history is cyclical. You can see what's going to happen by knowing what's happened before. And even as we watch church fads come and go, we don't need to worry. We always see God's faithfulness when we study those who have not wavered in their commitment to Scripture. Again, request this 12-DVD set with your gift of any amount. It's called A Survey of Church History, and you can request it when you call us at 800-435-4343 or when you go to renewingyourmind.org. We think it's important to understand the historic doctrines that grew out of the Protestant Reformation. We here at Ligonier Ministries are making a conscious effort to convey these truths to as many people as possible. Another way we're doing that is through RefNet, our internet radio station. You can hear sound biblical teaching 24 hours a day. Listening is always free when you go to refnet.fm or listen on the go with a free RefNet app. Well, next Saturday, Dr. Godfrey returns to tell us more about the teachings of Arminius. Reformed churches in the Netherlands were polarized because of the teaching, and churches today are equally at odds over this doctrine. We'll learn more about that next Saturday here on Renewing Your Mind.